Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a term of art that's been making the rounds among China experts in recent years. It's called the Thucydides Trap, and it was coined by my guest today. He says history shows that old empires and rising empires are almost destined for war unless visionary leaders steer them clear of conflict. And he says the U.S. and China fit that model. This hour on Point, how the U.S. and China can avoid a future war. You can join us on air or online. Do you think this world is big enough for two great empires to coexist harmoniously, the U.S. and China? Do you see a day of reckoning coming? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And later this hour, actress Helen Mirren's wisdom for the next generation of graduates at Tulane University. Before we turn to my main guest today and his thoughts on China and the U.S., we want to spend a few minutes on some news out of Europe. This weekend, German Chancellor Angela Merkel raised eyebrows on both sides of the Atlantic when she said that in the Trump era, Europe may just have to go it alone. Joining me now from Brussels is Ryan Heath. He's senior EU correspondent for Politico Europe. Ryan, thanks for joining me.
A pleasure to be here, Sasha.
And Ryan, let's hear Angela Merkel's lines or quotes directly. This was on Sunday, the day after President Trump flew back from Europe to Washington. She spoke at a campaign event. Key to note here, it was a campaign event in Munich, organized by the Christian Social Union in Bavaria. She said that her meetings last week, including with Trump, has changed the way she sees Europe's relationship with the U.S. And here is a clip from that speech interpreted by Press TV.
Völlig verlassen konnten.
The times in which we can fully count on others are somewhat over, as I've understood over the past few days. Therefore, I can only say that we Europeans must really take our destiny into our own hands. Of course, in friendship with the United States, in friendship with Great Britain, and in good neighborly relations, when possible, with Russia and other countries. But we should know that we have to fight for our future ourselves.
Ryan Heath, we've heard some interpretations of that, including from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. They said that this challenged the entire order that has underpinned Western stability since the end of World War II. That's a very dramatic interpretation. We have the other people saying it seems like much ado about nothing, that it's really been consistent with what she's saying for a long time. How do you interpret that?
I would take a position somewhat in the middle. It certainly does put that Western order on the table for discussion. But in many ways, Donald Trump and the Brexit campaign before him were also putting that order back on the table for discussion. So I think Merkel used quite a few qualifiers in her remarks. So she wasn't making a direct challenge, but she is a very deliberate person. And what she's saying is that she gave Donald Trump a chance in the several meetings that she's had with him. And she thinks, essentially, that it's time for Germany to grow out of the stage where West Germany was essentially a protected state by the United States. And Germany is obviously also seen as a leader now within the European Union context. And when you have people like the UK creating distance, the US keeping a bit of distance on the policy side as well, now it's time for Germany and others to really step up and organize themselves and not rely on others.
Ryan, you mentioned qualifiers, and I think that's important to point out because she said the era in which we could fully rely on others is over to some extent. So again, she's not saying it as if it's a blanket change. So to some degree, is this simply a reasonable interpretation of what's been going on, particularly since the U.S. election and since some of the key elections in Europe?
Absolutely. But I think the timing matters as well. Merkel's a very deliberate person. She knew what she was saying, and she knew that she was saying it in the direct aftermath of these two summits that she's had with Trump in the past week. So, you know, you must take that into account. But it says something about our own reactions to events in the sense that many people are worried about what impact new administrations like the Trump administration are having, the rise of populists within Europe. So it's not just the words that Merkel said, it's our reaction to it that's interesting. And I think that's why it suddenly went so viral and got people worried, because people are more generally fearing that there might be a great rupture coming, rather than pinning the rupture exactly on those words from Merkel.
And the context of the summits, as you mentioned, is also important. We're coming off Trump attacking Germany's trade surplus with the U.S., refusing to pledge support for the Paris Climate Accords. So in the context of that, we also have Merkel acknowledging that there's a different leader in charge in the U.S., and that might require a different relationship between Germany and the U.S.
Absolutely. And there are different administrations in the U.S. from time to time. It's not that Europeans haven't faced this before. There were certainly differences, if you remember, between old Europe and new Europe in whether they were supporting the Bush administration around the Iraq War. So it's not as though the U.S. and Europe have always seen eye to eye on policy issues. But I think the style that Donald Trump brings to the discussion is probably more unsettling, or as unsettling, as some of the actual policy differences. And that's where Europeans aren't quite sure where that's going to land, or how they should respond to it. And they have an element of self-esteem and self-pride that requires them to show that they're different or able to throw it back at the Trump administration if they feel that there are difficult messages coming out. But by the same token, they also know that the U.S. is the superpower in the world. It is the greatest ally of the European Union. So they're not going to throw that relationship overboard just on the basis of a few harsh words or a bad meeting.
And Ryan Heath, in your view, how does the election of Emmanuel Macron, the new leader of France, who is passionately pro-European Union, factor into this?
Well, I think what it really does is push the EU, or the 27 that will be left in 2019, into a more united space. So they have now a motor at the heart of Europe, which is France and Germany, who are really committed to working together and completing some of the elements of the EU that were just never finished off in the course of its first 60 years. And now they have something to define themselves against, which is a United Kingdom that is trying to leave the European Union and an administration in Washington that's a bit more hostile. So hopefully that will actually feed into the EU being a more coherent player. So even though there might be policy disagreements, at least the EU will be someone that the US and the UK and others such as China can rely on. And that's not always the case at the moment, because the EU can be quite divided and quite slow in coming to agreements with these other powers.
And Angela Merkel has an election coming up, which might make it particularly important for her to be speaking directly to her people and have her people feel reassured by her.
Absolutely. She's facing a strong challenge from a left-wing challenger who used to be the president of the European Parliament, a man called Martin Schulz. And he has made no bones about saying he will not support this 2% defense spending target that the NATO members have agreed to and that Trump has pushed so hard on. And there has always been a strain of anti-Americanism inside German politics. So Angela Merkel doesn't want to give in to that, but she has to acknowledge that there are flavors of that in the discussion. And as all politicians do, she amps up that rhetoric a little bit when she's in that domestic scene. But she's a very smart, tough cookie. So I imagine that she didn't want to go too far, but that she meant every word she said.
Right, very deliberate. Ryan Heath is senior EU correspondent for Politico Europe. Ryan, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
A pleasure.
And now from the U.S. and Europe to the U.S. and China. Joining me from New York is Graham Allison. He's director of Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. And he's been making the case for the Thucydides trap for several years. He'll describe to us shortly what that is. His ideas caught the attention of President Obama and China's president, Xi Jinping. And Graham Allison has just published a book about it. It's called Destined for War: Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Graham Allison, it's good to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
So can you give us an explainer of what this trap is? What is the risk of it to the United States?
Well, when a rising power threatens to displace a ruling power, doo-doo happens. Alarm bells should sound. Extreme danger ahead. Thucydides captured this insight as he analyzed the relationship between Athens and Sparta, and in a famous sentence said, quote, "It was the rise of Athens and the fear that this instilled in Sparta that made war inevitable." I've looked at the last 500 years and found 16 cases in which a rising power threatened to displace a ruling power. In 12 of these cases, the outcome was war. In 4 cases, the outcome was not war. So when Thucydides said inevitable, I take that as hyperbole. That was exaggeration. He just means likely, even very likely. But I think his insight is a powerful one that we've seen played over historically over these 2,500 years, and very particularly, for example, 100 years ago in World War I.
You also talk about how the United States in general, you believe, underestimates how powerful China has become, or maybe has this faint sense that eventually China will rival us. But in fact, they may not realize that we have been outpaced on so many measures. I think you've talked to your own students about this. Give a sense of how people can be surprised by this.
Well, this is something I learned from Lee Kuan Yew, who was the world's premier China watcher, the founder of Singapore, who built it over 30 years. And he said, you Americans have simply not awakened to the fact that basically when Ronald Reagan became president, China did not appear on any of the international league tables. Its economy was less than 10% of the U.S. In 2014, the big takeaway at the IMF World Bank meeting was China has become number one, measured by purchasing power parity, which is what the IMF and also the CIA believe is the single best yardstick for measuring national economies. China's economy became bigger than the U.S., and it's about 10% larger today, and on the current trajectory will be half again larger by 2024. So just in our lifetime, a country that was didn't even appear has now become so large, and therefore, when we look at it on every domain, every day, China appears more and more in our face. I mentioned in the classroom that basically I give people a quiz in which I have 26 indicators in which the question is, when could China become number one? This is in a Harvard classroom. Most of the students are graduate students. And they say, well, maybe 2040 this, maybe not in my lifetime, not this. Then I show them chart two, which is the same chart in which the headline is already.
Right. Yes, correct, that it has already happened. What they predicted would be in the future is the current. In fact, you paraphrase Vaclav Havel with this great quote saying that China's rise has been so rapid that it's been too fast for us to even notice, that we're kind of too quick for us to be astonished. When we come back from a break, we're going to pick up again. We're going to talk about what history tells us about what happens when two great powers collide. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about an idea coined by my guest today called the Thucydides Trap. You can join the conversation. When Graham Allison warns us that war with China is a lot more likely than we realize, what do you say? How do you think these two empires can compete and cooperate on the world stage for political power, for wealth, for resources? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And again, my guest is Graham Allison. He's author of the new book, Destined for War, Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? Graham, you were talking about the studies you have done in which you look at, I believe, 16 cases over history. Do I have the number right? 16
over the last 500 years.
In which all but four of them result in war when there's a rising power that essentially conflicts with an established power. So give us a sense of what it takes for that not to happen. When you saw war not result, what were the differentiators there?
Well, the two most instructive cases are the rise of the U.S. at the beginning of the 20th century to basically rival and eventually overshadow the U.K. So this happens from about 1880s, 90s, right through to the beginning of the 20th century. And the second, the Cold War, where, again, it's hard for Americans to believe, but when John Kennedy became president, he believed, and the establishment believed, that the Soviet Union was going to overtake the U.S. by the end of the 70s. So there was a surge of the Soviet economy that looked like it was going to rival and even, as I say, surpass the U.S. In both of these cases, you had huge amounts of imagination. The Cold War, I think, is perhaps the most instructive instance where, again, hard for people to remember, but in 1946, so just 1 year after the end of World War II, George Kennan, the famous diplomat who was stationed to the Soviet Union, wrote the famous long telegram. And he said, the Soviet Union is going to be a bigger and more persistent threat than Nazism ever was. Nobody in Washington wanted to hear this. We were exhausted from war. That triggered a conversation which, over the next 4 years, was the most creative period ever in American diplomacy, where people invented the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan to reconstruct Europe. NATO was built in as a result of that, the U.S.-Japanese Defense Treaty, the whole set of international financial institutions, what we now think of as the international order. That was all part of a strategy for defeating the evil empire. And that strategy was pursued over 4 decades by Republican and Democratic administrations to the point of victory. So I would say from history, we have many, many clues about how wise visionary statesmen have been able to construct an ability to cope with a complicated situation. In the British case, it's another story where basically they adapted and adjusted to a country that was destined to be larger than they were, substantially larger, but in a way that the interests became aligned. And when the U.S. entered World War I, we entered as an ally of Britain. And when the U.S. entered World War II, we entered as an ally of Britain. So I think there's a lot of lessons there for people who are prepared to, you know, look at history.
Graham Allison, the idea that the U.S. and China fit the Thucydides trap became so well circulated that President Xi Jinping of China himself ended up addressing this issue. He was speaking in September 2015 in Seattle, and he talked about the phrase that you applied to China, and he said that there's no reason that nations have to fall into that trap. Here he is.
There is no such thing as the so-called Thucydides trap in the world. But should major countries time and again make the mistakes of strategic miscalculation, they might create such traps for themselves.
So again, that's the president of China himself. Graham, when you hear him say that there's no such thing as the Thucydides trap, but then he does refer to strategic miscalculations that create traps, how do you interpret that? It sounds like he's saying that two different ways that are that conflict a little.
Well, I think what he's saying is that the Thucydides, the there's no necessity in the world to be caught by Thucydides' trap, that it is not necessary that parties, that when you have a rivalry between a rising power and a ruling power, that this has to go into the war column. As he says, it's the mistakes that the parties make that lead to that. And I agree with this. If you look at in my cases, the ones that I, you know, these cases I've described in the book, these are rare, almost without exception. It's not that one nation decides, oh, this is a good time for war. So this, the rising power is rising, I better go into war with it. Or the ruling power, it's time for me to go to war with it.
Right. No, in fact, you say that sometimes when there are these tensions, even small slights can result in real catastrophes.
Absolutely. The point is that under these conditions of severe substructural stress, events on the surface, which would otherwise be inconsequential or easily manageable, can cascade to consequences that nobody would have imagined. I mean, how in the world could the assassination of an archduke in Sarajevo by Serbian terrorists have been the match that created a fire, that created a conflagration so devastating that historians had to establish a whole new category, World War. That's right. Why it's called World War I. And even you go back and look at it after, I have a chapter on it on the road to 1914. It's a fascinating story, and it's unbelievable because nobody wanted war. At the end of the war, nobody got what he wanted. If they'd given a chance for a do-over, everybody would have made different decisions, but war came.
Graham Allison, you have a great line in the book where you say that if Hollywood were making a movie pitting China against U.S. on a path to war, central casting could not find two better leading actors than Xi Jinping and Trump. And you draw these analogies. We have Trump saying he's going to make America great again, whereas we have China's president saying he wants a grand rejuvenation. You also talk about both of these countries having superiority complexes that make them have inevitable collisions. Let's hear Donald Trump himself talking when he was running for presidency, really tough on China. He repeatedly accused China of, quote, raping the United States. Here he was a year ago at a campaign rally in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
When the Chinese traders come in, and they come in 20 at a time, they come in all the way. But when the Chinese come in and they want to make great trade deals, and they make the best trade deals, and not anymore. When I'm there, we turn it around, folks. We turn it around. We have a $500 billion deficit. Trade deficit with China. We're going to turn it around, and we have the cards. Don't forget, we're like the piggy bank that's being robbed.
Now, Graham Allison, Donald Trump has moderated his words toward China a bit since then. But what is adding the spark or the accelerant or the fuel of Trump due to the recipe that you've been talking about?
Well, I've thought a lot about this, and I'm not sure I have a good answer. But I think if Thucydides, if we asked him, he would say, well, in part, Trump is an expression of this Thucydidean dynamic. Ruling powers become fearful as they see a rising power all around it, and they imagine that it's even more hostile in intent than it is, and therefore are inclined to leadership, which therefore overreact. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, I think Donald Trump is somebody that we haven't seen like him previously. And so I think when he expresses himself, he often does in rhetoric that's a little bit beyond the conversation that had gone on previously. And as you say, in the campaign, campaign rhetoric is always different than the way that people govern. So the characterization of the relationship at Mar-a-Lago with the summit with Xi Jinping is quite different than what we heard on the campaign. Where it's going to come out, I don't know. I think the most dangerous piece of it right now is the North Korean piece, where basically, at Mar-a-Lago, Trump said to Xi Jinping, look, you have to solve this problem, and this is going to be the test of the relationship between China and the U.S. I think this may be an insoluble problem, but in any case, to make the China relationship bear all the weight of it, I think, is dangerous.
And North Korea is a key part of this. China has obviously long propped up North Korea, and Trump wants China's cooperation to rein in North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. Just yesterday, there was a report from CBS News on North Korea's latest missile test. That was this weekend. Let's hear a piece of that.
North Korea fired yet another ballistic missile overnight, part of an escalating series of tests. The newest missile was launched from the country's east coast. It flew about 280 miles before landing in the sea off the coast of Japan.
Graham Allison, do you see the U.S. rising tensions with North Korea as the kind of thing that could become a spark to create a war with China?
Absolutely. I think the similarities, unfortunately, between this and an assassination in Sarajevo are frightening. So basically, the situation on the Korean Peninsula is hard for anybody to believe. How can a little teeny isolated country be building nuclear weapons and have a capability soon to threaten to attack San Francisco or Los Angeles with nuclear weapons? It makes no sense. Just completely out of the picture. But it's a fact. So on the one hand, in the foreseeable future, if left uninterrupted, North Korea will have the ability to attack San Francisco or Los Angeles with nuclear weapons. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, since the very instant that he heard about this from President Obama in the transition, Trump tweeted, and he's been saying ever since, not going to happen. Never going to happen on my watch. So he's drawn as sharp a line as he's drawn about any subject, saying he's not going to let North Korea be able to attack the U.S. He's going to come to a point in which he's going to either have to decide to eat his words, which he's shown a capacity for doing, or alternatively, attack North Korea, which we can do to prevent it from testing more missiles, which would give it the capability to attack our West Coast. Well, but if we attack North Korea, what's going to happen? And I think, again, American intelligence community thinks that North Korea will respond by attacking Seoul and probably killing a million people in the first 24 hours. And what then are we going to do? We're likely to respond by destroying all of the rest of North Korea's capability to attack and kill 10 million more South Koreans, in which case now we have the Second Korean War. And in the First Korean War, most Americans don't remember, but China entered the First Korean War and beat us back down the peninsula to the 38th parallel where we had to sue for an armistice. So China's made it pretty clear they're not going to have a unified Korea on China's border that's in a military ally of the U.S. So I think this is an extremely dangerous situation.
Let's go to a caller. This is Sarah calling from Medina, Ohio. Sarah, welcome to On Point, and tell us what you think as you listen to this conversation.
Hi, Sasha. I was calling because earlier you posed the question of whether or not your guest was right to be ringing this alarm. And I just wanted to put out there that I think, yes, it's absolutely right. My husband is Chinese, and I've studied Chinese for many years, and I've spent a lot of time in China amongst Chinese people, mostly with my husband's family. And I think that I've been blessed to be able to see, you know, through my study of the culture and spending time with the people, been able to see, you know, both sides of the coin on certain issues, like with Korea and things like Tibet and Taiwan. And so I think that your guest is right to raise the alarm, because I think that Americans are woefully unaware and oblivious to international affairs and other points of view. And, you know, not to say that, I'm not saying who's right, but I think that the world would be a very different place if we could kind of understand and come to see things from different points of view and have respect for those other cultures.
Sarah, does war seem like a possibility to you as you think about your relationship with your husband and what you've learned from China through him?
Well, that's kind of interesting. That was my second point, is that my husband, and I guess, you know, he takes a lot of pride in saying that, I guess there's this sentiment among a lot of Chinese people that China is the only country that can't be provoked or something, which, I mean, I think is kind of untrue. But I think they pride themselves on the fact that they don't go around picking fights or getting involved in other people's wars. And I think, you know, as contrasting to America, where we kind of, you know, go off into the Middle East and Vietnam and, you know, these sorts of things. So they kind of pride themselves on that. And so I think amongst most Chinese people, they would probably say, well, if there's going to be a war, it's going to come from America. And so I was kind of wondering if
that America would be the instigator.
Yeah. And so I was wondering if maybe your guest had heard of this kind of sentiment, perhaps, among Chinese people, and if maybe he could speak to that.
Thanks for that call. And actually, let me bring in another voice so we can get two perspectives on that. I also want to add David Rennie. He's the Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist at The Economist. And David was former Beijing bureau chief for The Daily Telegraph, also traveled to China with then Secretary of State John Kerry. David Rennie, before we hear Graham Allison's perspective, welcome to the show and tell us what you think about that caller's view.
Hi, Sasha. I think that's right. I think it's actually speaks to what Graham Allison describes very well and slightly sort of alarmingly in his book, is that massive perception gap, that one of the problems when you have two great powers rubbing up against each other is that both sides tend to think that they're the reasonable, virtuous one, and it's the other country that is being unreasonable. And that is yet another reason why you get miscalculations. It's absolutely true that the Chinese government, which has basically ditched orthodox communist economic theory, has filled the gap with nationalism. And it's a very, very nationalist country with a public that is very fired up about China needing to take its proper place in the world as a front rank country. And that's another reason, I think, that Graham's book is pretty worrying.
And Graham, in terms of what you think of the caller's view, and David Rennie adding that usually it's the country, we think it's the other country that's the instigator. I mean, given that the next war is very likely to be a nuclear one, is that not likely to make China and the U.S. really pause before they might go there?
Well, there's 3 points here. So, yes, on the nuclear. One of the things about nuclear weapons is they have a crystal ball effect in which you therefore notice that if you go to war, you may end up killing all of us, including us, and therefore people are more cautious. And I think that's one of the elements in which a constructive and visionary foreign policy could have managed to try to build a relationship. But to the caller's point, I thought she made two excellent points, and I agree with David. I mean, first is Chinese believe they are simply being restored to their normal place at the center of the universe. This is not an American idea. This is a Chinese idea. The word China in Mandarin means center of the universe. Everybody else is positioned around us, they think. And they say that for 5,000 years, we were the ruling nation in the globe, except for the last 200 years when Westerners came here and exploited us. So we're just going back to our natural place. And as we go back to our natural place, we believe we should have more say, we should have more sway, our interests should have more influence. And those conditions generally, as David said, they exaggerate misperceptions and misunderstandings, because I see things only through my eyes, which is why I think the caller's especially interesting. Where you now have more and more families that have a Chinese and an American, where you have children that are looking at it through two eyes, we may be able to see a little bit better.
Right. The more we see the rest of the world through other cultures and through other eyes, maybe the less likely we are for that war to happen. When we come back from the break, we continue our conversation with Graham Allison and David Rennie about the U.S. and China and whether these two great nations are headed for conflict and what it will take for us to avoid that. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how great powers almost inevitably end up at war and how to avoid that outcome. Join this conversation. Let us know if you think the U.S. government is underestimating the threats posed by China. Can the U.S. learn to live with China? And will China be content to live with us as an equal superpower? My guests are Graham Allison, author of the new book, Destined for War, Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? And David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist at The Economist. Graham and David, we have several callers that want to weigh in, and I want to go to Jim from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, welcome to On Point. Tell us your thoughts as you listen to this conversation.
Thanks for taking my call. My perspective is that U.S. economic policy, which has fabulously enriched a small number of Americans, is essentially responsible for financing China's rise. So my first question would be, has there been any precedent for the so-called prey, that the superpower that's being under attack, actually financing the enemy that it sees? And in this age of globalism, where obviously war with China will immensely damage a number of American economic interests who are well connected, what role do they see that playing in the reality of a war between these two countries?
Sure, and let me add something to that, which is that the China market has, as you pointed out, Jim, allowed many or some Americans to become very rich. It's more people to buy things, more things to sell. It's cheaper things that Americans can buy in this country. So there is a lot of economic benefit in many ways. So Graham Allison, David Rennie, can you give us your thoughts on that? And Graham Allison, would you start us off?
Sure, it's a big issue, I would say, and I'd be interested in David's perspective on it. Clearly, you have a thick economic interpenetration of the U.S. and China. So basically, Walmarts would be empty if Chinese goods didn't appear, and Chinese factories wouldn't have anything to produce if Walmarts weren't taking them. In addition, the U.S. has been borrowing from China to pay for our deficits over this significant period of time. China holds about $2 trillion of American debt. So this is a degree of interpenetration that we haven't seen before. On the other hand, if we go back to World War I, the relationships between Britain and Germany were also thickly interdependent economically, so interdependent that was a great book written, the bestseller of the time, in the years right before World War I, by a fellow named Angel, called The Great Illusion, in which he said war was now obsolete because nations were so economically interdependent that they simply couldn't go to war with each other. And we saw how that worked out.
And David Rennie, would you also address the caller's point, Jim from Omaha, about whether there's been in history a case of a established superpower essentially financing the military and economic rise of a rising superpower?
Well, I think that Jim is clearly tapping into language we heard both from Bernie Sanders on the left, but also clearly from Donald Trump on the right in the last election. It was a kind of very populist argument that really something that America has a right to, which is to make a lot of stuff, had been stolen from it. And somehow China had, to add insult to injury, had kind of got America to pay for all this. I think the Chinese would see it very differently. They would see themselves more as, it's a bit like a shopkeeper who has an extremely profligate customer and they keep extending credit to that customer. I mean, who's winning there? I mean, China is extending credit to America to finance. I mean, Jim said that China's economic policy has financed, America has financed China's rise. Well, China would say they financed American shopping for a long time. And so I think one thing that is important to note in this is the big historical run, which is from the Chinese perspective, they just came back. The idea that something wrong happened, something illegitimate happened, which is that China is competing with American factories. From China's perspective, particularly that period of kind of hardline communism and Maoism, when they basically destroyed the Chinese economy, that was ended by these far-sighted reformers like Deng Xiaoping. And essentially, between 1989 and 1999, that kind of big jump of entering the global economy, China came back. China had been absent artificially from the global economy and is now taking its rightful place back. So that's another reason that I think Graham's book is pointing to this massive gap of perceptions, that people like Jim and lots of Americans think that something that's rightfully America's was stolen by China. The Chinese just think they came back.
And to David's point, there's a startling fact in your book, Graham, that says that in 1980, China's economy was smaller than that of the Netherlands. And now we have a world superpower. So that certainly hammers home how quickly China's rise has been. But, you know, as our caller referred to, the market issues, if these two countries could coexist harmoniously, there could be enormous financial benefit to both of them. So it's clearly in their interest to do that. What would it take, Graham Allison, for the U.S. and China to coexist harmoniously?
Well, I try to struggle with this in the conclusion of the book, and I say Washingtonians will be disappointed that I don't roll out a grand new strategy with three to-dos and promise that if you take an aspirin, things will all get better. I think actually what we're facing is a challenge of Thucydidean proportions. The rise of a 5,000-year-old civilization with 1.4 billion people is not a problem to be fixed. It's a condition that we're going to have to cope with over a generation. But then to the specifics, I think if you imagine adults sitting down, so Xi and Trump imagine at Mar-a-Lago, and say, what do we have in common and where are areas of competition? In terms of nuclear weapons, as you already said, we can't have a nuclear war because if we do, we'll kill all of each other. So that's a powerful reason, something we have in common. Secondly, with respect to our economies, we can imagine the two economies becoming so that they're actually not just interdependent, but synergistic to the benefit of both of them, creating a bigger pie. We can have some arguments about how the pie is divided. Thirdly, climate. Now, I know this is not President Trump's thing, but it's a fact that if China does everything it could do to try to make a livable climate and the U.S. does nothing, If the U.S. does everything it could do and China not, lose. So this is, again, something that can only be done jointly. So there are plenty of elements that you could imagine parties working with if the U.S. was prepared to, in Lee Kuan Yew's terms, share the 21st century of Asia with China and vice versa. But that would require some considerable changes on the mindset of both Chinese and Americans, not just the leaders, but also the thinking populations across both societies.
Let's hear another piece of tape that get at what might seem like a skirmish that could be the kind of incident that could lead to something much more disastrous. And this is a piece of tape from CBS This Morning on Sunday. It's tape from CNN. CNN ended up having some firsthand experience with a Chinese foreign military craft warning the U.S. to leave their military alert zone.
The U.S. plane was ordered a number of times to go away. CNN was on board the plane and heard the warnings from China.
Foreign military aircraft, this is Chinese Navy. You are approaching our military alert zone. Leave immediately.
David Rennie, that's just Sunday. Is that run-of-the-mill, or is that the kind of thing that most Americans may not be aware of that really show that tensions could become military?
Not only tensions where you have a kind of a fairly controlled engagement like that, there's a lot of potential for accidents. And one of the things you hear when you speak to American military people who work in China's backyard is that the Chinese have a lot of new firepower, a lot of new ships, a lot of kind of quasi-military shipping out there and aircraft. And they're not quite as good technically as they think they are. And one of the things that frightens American officers most is the chance of an accident. When I was based in China more than a decade ago, we had a spy plane knocked out of the sky by a Chinese fighter that was sort of hot-dogging it. And that nearly ended in real tragedy with the plane forced to land. I think one of the fascinating things about Donald Trump in all of this is you could draw up a pessimistic list where he is the worst possible president to handle this kind of accidental collision because he's got a short attention span, he's never held this kind of job before. You could also draw up a kind of cynical but optimistic list that actually, because he doesn't care about human rights, democracy promotion, or really very much about allies, he's a very unusual American president, and maybe he's the kind of person who could do a kind of not very morally impressive deal, but he could do a deal with China.
We heard earlier in the hour some of Trump's more incendiary talk about China, this when he was on the campaign trail. But now that he's in the White House, he's become a bit more moderate. So let's hear a piece of tape. When he was at his summit last month with Chinese President Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago, he took a much more diplomatic tone and predicted that the two countries will resolve their serious issues. This is when he was actually with the Chinese president.
I think truly progress has been made. We'll be making a lot of additional progress. The relationship developed by President Xi and myself, I think, is outstanding. We look forward to being together many times in the future. And I believe lots of very potentially bad problems will be going away.
David Rennie, that's pretty positive, pretty optimistic. How do you think the China-U.S. relationship plays out in the Trump era?
So it's a real puzzle. So because I'm an ex-China guy, I've interviewed Donald Trump for The Economist three times, and China's come up each time because it's something it's very interesting. He's really hard to read on this because you're right that on the campaign trail he says these ferocious things. That was one of the ways that he got elected. But actually, certainly the most recent time that The Economist went to see him was about 3 weeks ago in the Oval Office. He was sort of smitten. It was a kind of bromance with Xi Jinping. He was talking about, you know, I like him and I think he likes me. I think he likes me a lot. And it went sort of fantastically well. And he was talking about the history lesson that Xi Jinping had given him about how many thousands of years of history Chinese, you know, culture has. And he seemed very sort of dazzled by this. He's very convinced that if he can persuade China that it's in China's interest to deal with North Korean nukes, that they'll kind of do a deal easily. I mean, the truth is that many American presidents have tried to make exactly that same argument. There is this very, very strange thing. We have a president who really isn't like any other American president in terms of his sheer lack of interest in values and American moral leadership. And that could be a catastrophe. And in many ways, you can see, we played the tape at the beginning with Angela Merkel, clearly a catastrophe for Europeans. Maybe, if you're a kind of wild optimist, that could be the key to a China deal, a kind of grubby, nasty China deal.
And David Rennie, what did you think overall about the prediction that Graham Allison makes in his book, that war could be more likely than we realize?
Look, I think it clearly is the case that China has risen far faster than people realize. And the sheer kind of amount of contact that we now see in the South China Sea, you can see all kinds of allies already running scared. It's really interesting that if you go back just a couple of years, countries like Australia, one of America's closest allies, they were quite keen on the idea of kind of pushing back the Chinese in the South China Sea, doing their own overflights. Australians don't want anything to do with that now. They're really running scared. I'm about to go tomorrow with the Defense Secretary, James Mattis, to Asia, to Southeast Asia. And a lot of those Southeast Asian allies, 2-3 years ago, they were saying to America, make sure you don't leave us on our own with China. Make sure you stick around. Make sure you hedge them, contain them. I think they're a lot less confrontational now. There's a sense that China really has got the upper hand. So the stakes in the region are very, very high, and the region understands that. And I think one of the values of Graham's book is if Americans read it, they will hopefully understand just how high the stakes are.
And Graham Allison, briefly, on balance, would you say you're more optimistic or pessimistic about the prospect that the U.S. and China could go to war?
Well, I'm congenitally an optimist, so I'm not pessimistic. I'm not fatalistic. And I think that I actually like David's notion that there may be a deal here to be done and that Trump might even be the person to do it.
David Rennie is a Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist at The Economist. He joined us from Washington. And Graham Allison is director of Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs and author of Destined for War, Can America and China Escape the Thucydides Trap? David and Graham, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And in a moment, we'll be hearing Helen Mirren's address to the class of 2017 at Tulane University. This is On Point. Academy Award-winning actress Helen Mirren addressed graduates at Tulane University in New Orleans earlier this month. She spoke about the important role of the next generation, which she called Generation Empathy, Generation Cares, Generation Game Changers. It's a generation, she said, that is radical, brave, and often making trouble. And she shared the story about something that might tie her to that younger generation, tattoos.
I know it's hard to believe, but actually Dame Helen Mirren does have a tattoo. But I got my tattoo when only Hell's Angels, sailors, and convicted felons had them. I'll share you the story. When I was on my journey through young adulthood, in that glorious and confusing time that was the early 70s, ooh, bad fashion, I remember. I looked in a lot of different places for answers, Eastern, Western, all over the place. And when I found one inspiring answer in Mayan wisdom that said so much in so few words, I had it tattooed on my body. It's a simple phrase, in Lakesh. It means, you are my other self. We are one. I am another yourself. In the Bible it says, love thy neighbor. The Mayans were onto something. Because if I'm you, I have a responsibility to you. And if you're me, you have a responsibility to me. The Mayans just had a more beautiful way of saying, we're all in this together. We're all in this together. Remember that, so that you can make some sense and fix this crazy world. I know you'll do it. I know that the world you build will be so different from the world my parents envisioned. You know, I mean, a smartphone to them would have been as alien as a little green man from Mars. For you, it's just the starting point of the tools that will be at your disposal to fix much of what is broken. Robotics, computer intelligence, medical advances, the constant restless search for knowledge. Your lives will be so exciting, revelatory, awesome, in the truest sense of that word. And yet, the timeless truths of our common humanity, the ones that Shakespeare, Confucius, Moses, Christ, your grandparents, and the Mayans understood, those truths will never change. You are me, and I am you.
That's actress Helen Mirren addressing graduates at Tulane University in New Orleans earlier this month. For a video of her address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.